You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
Okay, Revelation chapter 10. Let's jump right in here and we'll continue with our tour through the trumpet judgments. We've had four of them, now we're going to get three more. And so in chapter 10, there's a little bit of a break. In fact, chapter 10 and 11 are kind of a, most of 11 are a break in the action. The seventh trumpet actually comes in verse 15 of chapter 11. So we're going to go up into heaven for a little while, and we're going to come back down to earth for a little while and just kind of get a catch up on the rest of the picture. You know, the hard thing that I think, the hardest thing for John to do here was to try and describe everything as it's happening. You know, if you're watching a football game, there's 22 people on the field and their whistle blows and everybody's going everywhere all at once, and you can see them all moving all the time, but if you were trying to describe it, you'd have to stop and describe each one of the 22 people individually, because you can't talk about two or three things at once. And so that's the difficulty in trying to keep something like this together. So every now and then John has to say, okay, let's blow the whistle, let's stop the action, let me catch up on things now and see, and we'll see what's going on, get some perspective about this. And so in chapter 10, we have verse 1, "Then I saw another mighty angel coming down from heaven. He was robed in a cloud with a rainbow above his head, and his face was like the sun, his legs were like fiery pillars. He was holding a little scroll which lay open in his hand. He planted his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land, and he gave a loud shout like the roar of a lion. And when he shouted, the voices of the seven thunders spoke. And when the seven thunders spoke," I was about to write down what I heard, but then I heard a voice from heaven say, "Seal up what the seven thunders have said, and do not write it down." Then the angel I had seen standing on the sea and on the land raised his right hand to heaven, and he swore by him who lives forever and ever, who created the heavens and all that's in them, and the earth and all that's in it, and the sea and all that's in it. And he said, "There will be no more delay. But in the days when the seventh angel is about to sound his trumpet, the mystery of God will be accomplished, just as he announced to his servants, the prophets." All right, so there's seven verses now. This mighty angel, I've seen a lot of different commentaries try and describe or identify who this actually is. Some people think it's the Lord, and some people think it's just one of the leaders of the angelic host. It doesn't really matter to us who he is, except that he is an authority figure that is announcing something coming. And I have not been persuaded by the commentaries I've read saying that this has to be the Lord, because although it's a very powerful figure and he obviously has a great deal of authority, the passage doesn't require that this be the Lord. Now, as far as the seven thunders are concerned, in verse 4, there's been a lot written about them too, because even though the voice of the Lord said, "Seal up what the seven thunders have said, and don't write it down," for the next 2,000 years, people have been trying to write down what the seven thunders said. And of course, nobody knows, so everybody takes guesses at it and tries to say, well, here's what they said. But the passage is clear. John was told not to write it down, that those things were to remain secret until the end of the age, when it became appropriate for us to know what those seven thunders said, then those will be revealed. But apparently, from what we can surmise here, it looks like an unknown cycle of judgment. You know, we had the seven seal judgments, then the seven trumpet judgments now, and then we're going to get to seven bowl judgments. And it appears that these seven thunders contain an unknown cycle of judgments that have been held back by God. They hasn't revealed to us until when it's time. Now, if you want to turn with me to Psalm 29, there's an interesting thing about these seven thunders, because, you know, when it says, when I heard in verse 4, it says, when the seven thunders spoke, he acts like we should know who the seven thunders are. He doesn't identify them, and he doesn't try to describe them to us, but he just talks about them as the seven thunders, as if we should know who they are. And I don't know whether they're in Psalm 29 or not, but Psalm 29 is interesting in the fact that it does make reference to them. So look at Psalm 29 And it says in verse 1, ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord glory, do his name. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Now starting in verse 3 and going through verse 9, or seven times the voice of the Lord is described as speaking out of thunder. And so let's read this. Voice, verse 3. The voice of the Lord is over the waters. The glory of the Lord thunders. The Lord thunders over the mighty waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic. The voice of the Lord breaks the cedars. The Lord breaks in pieces the cedars of Lebanon. He makes Lebanon skip like a calf. And Sirion, which is Mount Hermon, which is right at the border with Lebanon. And Sirion, like a young wild ox. It's the highest mountain in Israel. In fact, it's high enough so that even though the rest of the country is usually pretty warm, you can go skiing on Mount Hermon. It's the where the headwaters of the Jordan, a lot of the water that comes down the Jordan River. The reason why it's so cold is because it's snowmelt off Mount Hermon, and so it's still pretty cool by the time it gets here. The Jordan River, you know, flows right through the Sea of Galilee, and so it comes in the north end from the Mount Hermon, the stream flows right down the middle of the lake and comes out the south end and keeps on flowing. But Sirion here is a reference to Mount Hermon. The voice of the Lord strikes with flashes of lightning. The voice of the Lord shakes the desert. The voice of the Lord shakes the desert of Kadesh, which is down in the south. The voice of the Lord twists the oaks and strips the forest bare. And in his temple all cry, glory. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord is enthroned as king forever. The Lord gives strength to his people, and the Lord blesses his people with peace. And so there's Psalm 29. And as I said, the voice of the Lord listed seven times there, associated with thunder and with power. And it may be that is a veiled reference to what these seven thunders are. But I'm not going to speculate any further on that because I read the thing at the beginning of the book that says anybody adds to this book, they'd be cursed by the things they add to it. And so I don't want to get into that kind of trouble. I'm going to have enough trouble as it is without making some up for myself. And so in verse 6, he swears by him who lives forever and ever, which means he's swearing by God who created the heavens and all that's in them, and the earth is all in it, and the sea is all in it. And he says there will be no more delay. Now, what this means is that the great tribulation is about to start. What we've had for these first 10 chapters is the lead up. It's been the first half of the 70th week of Daniel. And now we're going to be getting into the Great Tribulation itself. The Antichrist makes his appearance in Revelation 13, actually right at the end of Revelation 12. And so when he says there'll be no more delay, now some of your Bibles might say time shall be no more, but that's an awkward translation. It really means time. The time for waiting is over, basically. No more waiting, no more delay. Remember earlier in the book when the souls of the martyrs first appeared in heaven and they said, how long, O Lord, are you going to delay judging these people? Well, here's their answer. The Lord told them back then, well, be patient. There's still some more martyrs coming up to join you. And we've got to wait until the full number has been brought in. But now he's saying, okay, now your prayers will be answered. Now time, there'll be no more delay. Now will be the time when all of the mysteries of God will be revealed, and all of the things that the people have been speculating about what's going to happen in these end time judgments will be made clear. All right, then the verse 8, the voice that I had heard from heaven spoke to me once more. He said, go take the scroll that lies open in the hand of the angel who was standing on the sea and on the land. Remember, this giant angel had a little scroll in his hand. And so I went to the angel and asked him to give me the little scroll. And he said to me, take it and eat it. It'll turn your stomach sour, but in your mouth it'll be as sweet as honey. So I took the little scroll from the angel's hand and ate it. It tasted sweet as honey in my mouth, but when I had eaten it, my stomach turned sour. And then I was told you must prophesy again about many peoples, nations, languages, and kings. And so the symbolism that we're trying to create here, that John is trying to create, is that this little scroll is apparently holding words that describe the judgments that are coming. And the reason it tastes sweet as honey in John's mouth when he tastes it is because he knows that God is just and righteous and that the world deserves the judgments that are coming. And so it's like the truth. It's like people are getting what's coming to them. It's like justice is being served, and it's characterized or it's symbolized here by being sweet. In other words, we all And we feel the same way, don't we? When we see all the evil and all the mean and bad and terrible stuff in the world, we all have this kind of feeling in the back of our minds, won't it be nice when the Lord fixes all that? And we really feel good about the fact that he's going to do that someday. And that's kind of a thought that is comparable to the scroll tasting sweet as honey, because we know it's right, we know it's good, we know it's the thing that's required, we know it's the thing that everybody deserves, and so that part of it's good. However, when we actually see the judgments being levied against people, it's enough to make you sick, because the evil has been allowed to go on so long, and it's been so unbridled, that when it is finally punished, the punishment has to be really severe. And that part we don't like, because a couple billion people die, and you know there's earthquakes, and there's natural and supernatural things coming to happen on earth, and it's not going to be pleasant to watch. And that's what's being symbolized by the fact that it turns sour in your stomach. And so I don't know how many of you remember the first Gulf War, how leading up to it, we all thought, okay, Saddam Hussein's going to get what he deserves now, and it's time for him to, judgment's coming down on him. And that was a positive thought for us. That was a good thought. But when we saw the destruction, when we saw the bombs actually going into buildings and blowing them up, and we saw the people dying and all that, that's not fun to look at. It's not fun to watch. And this was one of the very first times where you could see all this as it was happening. You know, it's like you were right there in the airplane cockpit with the pilot, watching the bomb go down into the window of the building. The building disappears. You see just what the pilot sees, and you know it's happening at that exact moment. And you know that all the people in the building have ceased to exist. And that's hard to watch. I mean, you know, it's much more pleasant to think about it from afar than it is to be right involved. And so that's what the scroll thing looks like. Now this little a concept of eating a scroll and tasting like honey, but then turning your stomach sour, this is not the first time this has happened. There's another one that we can refer to here. It's in Ezekiel chapter 2, and it has to do with the judgment of Jerusalem during the time of the fall of Jerusalem during the Babylonian captivity, or at the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. In Ezekiel 2, I think it is. Yeah, Ezekiel's, this is the call of Ezekiel. And God's telling him that he's going to be, before we get done here, and we won't read the whole passage, but I'll just let you know, Ezekiel's going to be appointed as God's watchman. Watchman on the wall. That's where the concept comes from, is from this chapter of Ezekiel. And the idea is here, God's saying to Ezekiel, if I tell you somebody's going to be judged for what they've done, and you tell them, and they disregard you, then that's on their head. But if I tell you and you don't tell them, then what happens to them is going to be on your head. So that's kind of how he got Ezekiel to agree to do the watchman bit. And so what he's saying is, when we get to 2 verse 9, he says, "Then I looked and I saw a hand stretched out to me, and it was a scroll which was unrolled before me. On both sides of it were written words of lament and mourning and woe. And he said to me, Son of man, eat what is before you, eat this scroll, and then go and speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth and he gave me the scroll to eat. He said to me, Son of man, eat the scroll I'm giving you, and it will, and fill your stomach with it. So I ate it, and it tasted sweet as honey in my mouth." Okay, well, then it goes on to describe. See, Ezekiel's in Babylon now, and he went with the first. There were three groups of hostages taken to Babylon altogether, and Ezekiel went with either the first or second one. I can't remember which. He and Daniel both were taken hostage to Babylon. Jeremiah was left in Jerusalem, and so you had three writers at that point, three major prophets writing about this Babylonian captivity, Ezekiel and Daniel from Babylon and Jeremiah from Jerusalem. And what Ezekiel is being told to tell the other captives in Babylon is that Jerusalem is about to be destroyed. The temple is about to be sacked, burned down. The city's going to be destroyed. The walls torn down, and everything's going to just be leveled put the torch to be put to it. And so they're thinking about all the things that they've left behind and how that's all going to be gone. And God's saying to them, if you tell them, then you've done your job. If you don't tell them, then it's going to be a problem. And so Ezekiel had a very hard ministry, very difficult one. He and Isaiah, Jeremiah got so mad he refused to talk. And God made his throat burn so much he couldn't stop from talking. And so it's a... None of these guys had a good time about it. And the people didn't like any of them. And they tried their best to get rid of them. Jeremiah, they threw him down in the well and kept him there for a while. Isaiah, they actually stretched him out between two horses and sawed him in half. And so it was most people didn't aspire to the office of prophet in those days. Okay, back to Revelation now. And I think we're ready to start chapter 11. 10 was a shorty. And now we go to 11. And in chapter 11, we see John saying, I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar and count the worshipers there. But exclude the outer court. Do not measure it because it's been given to the Gentiles. And they'll trample on the holy city for 42 months. And I'll give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy for 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth. And these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. If anyone tries to harm them, fire comes out of their mouths and devours their enemies. And this is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. And these men have the power to shut up the sky so it will not rain during the time they are prophesying. And they have the power to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. All right, now we're going to get into something here that is controversial, as if the rest of the book isn't. The first thing is I want you to see is these two verses at the beginning of chapter 11, we know that there's a temple in Israel because John's told to go and measure it. And we know it's in the first half of the Revelation because we've just been told that the Great Tribulation is about to start. And that's the second half of that Daniel's 70th week. So we know that sometime in the first half of Daniel's 70th week, a temple gets built. Now, Daniel also alludes to this because he says, while he doesn't specifically state a temple being built, what he does say is in the middle of the 70th week, the temple will be desecrated. And so by implication, that means, well, it has to be there. It can't be desecrated till it's there. And then in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4, I think it is, Paul said that the one he calls the son of perdition, another name for the Antichrist, that he will stand in the temple and proclaim himself to be God. And so you have these three references to saying there will be a temple in Israel at the time of the end of the age. This is one of the reasons we know that the end of the age hasn't come yet, because there's no temple there yet. Now, you know, there were some people during the run-up to World War II who thought that this was looked like the start of the Great Tribulation, that Hitler must be the Antichrist and all this stuff. And a minority of people, Bible scholars, said, now wait, you're overlooking two things here. Number one, can't be the end of the age because in the late 30s there was no nation of Israel. So first of all, no Israel, so there can't be the end of the age. Secondly, no temple. And so while the events that took place there in Germany at the beginning of World War II and during the war were very very much descriptive of things that are going to happen at the end of the age, they were not the fulfillment of prophecy. But these three passages, the one in Daniel, the one here, and the one in 2 Thessalonians, tell us there's going to be a temple at the end of the age. And so one of the things that we're taught to look for as prophecy students, there are two very, very critical and obvious signs of where we stand at the end of the age. The first one is the nation Israel. All of end times prophecies key off of the reappearance, if you will, of the nation Israel. Up until 1948, there was no nation Israel. And so none of the end time prophecies could be fulfilled until then. In 1948, May 14th, the nation Israel was formed again. The only nation treated, having been destroyed and decimated and scattered all over to the four winds for 2,000 years. Now all of a sudden it comes back again, and it comes back speaking a pretty close facsimile of its original language. It comes back with the same notion, same ideas that it had when it was destroyed in 70 AD, between 70 and 135 AD, which was the final destruction. So that was the first one. And that said that, that tells us that the end times is beginning. And then right on the heels of that, Jesus had said in Luke chapter 20 that the city of Jerusalem would be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles were fulfilled. And what that meant was as long as the city of Jerusalem was in Gentile hands, then you know that the end of the age can't begin. And of course, even after Israel was formed, the city of Jerusalem was divided for 19 more years. And it wasn't until 1967 that Israel got the whole city of Jerusalem again. And so prophecy scholars saw that as another big sign that we're progressing. Now we've got the nation of Israel, and we got Jerusalem, a Jewish city again for the first time in 2,000 years, unified Jerusalem. The next big one is this temple. Because when you see that temple going, that tells us that we're somewhere in the last 7 years before the Lord's returned. And when you see the Antichrist standing in that temple proclaiming himself to be God, that tells you that there's 1,260 days, 3.5 years left. Now, they're starting to talk about this 1,260 day and 3.5 year thing. Some of these relate to that end and some of them don't. I'll try to separate them for you. But the simple fact is this temple, when it gets here, is going to be another huge sign for the people that are here on earth that we're getting deeper into the end of the age. For probably a couple of decades now, a group in Jerusalem has been preparing implements for use in the temple and has been preparing priests to officiate in the temple. They've woven their robes. And I don't, did you guys get to go to the Temple Institute?
The Temple Institute.
And so you saw the implements all
that,
the...
That was bold.
Yes, it's amazing. And they've been going at this for 20-some years. A rabbi named Chaim Richman, who I happen to know and had brought to Salt Lake City once to talk to our group there, was the head of the Temple Institute for a number of years. He, by the way, is now the head of the Great Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin has just been reorganized, and he's the temporary spokesperson for the Sanhedrin. So he's quite a pivotal character on this. But that's one thing that's happened. The Jews believe they're going to have a real temple. Okay? That's one thing. And that they'll be sacrificing animals again, yes. The second thing is, at the end of the battle of Ezekiel 38 and 39, when God says he's going to use that battle to open Israel's eyes to him again and to call them back into a relationship with him, the relationship he calls them back into is the same one that they left out of 2,000 years ago, and that's an old covenant relationship. Old covenant relationship with God requires a working temple. It can't be just a facsimile. It can't be just an attraction. It has to be a working temple. The whole nation of Israel is ceremonially unclean. There's not a single Jew alive today who could worship in a temple if they had one. And they can't become ceremonially clean until there is a temple. And so it's kind of a catch-22. And that's why you also see this interest in a breeding program over there for these red heifers, because it's the red heifer, it's the perfect red heifer that's required to cleanse them so they can be involved in their temple. And so there's that coming. And then the third thing is, when the Antichrist stands in that temple proclaiming himself to be God, Daniel's prophecy says it puts an end to the sacrifice and offering, which means that the sacrifice and offering had to be taking place. And so to me, it all adds up to be a legitimate temple. I think that when Israel sees how God miraculously defeats this Muslim coalition that's going to come after him in Ezekiel 39, they will realize that it's God who won that battle for him. He actually says in Ezekiel 39 that they'll realize it. They'll come running back to him. He will draw them back to them, and he'll draw them back into their Old Testament relationship. And so it all points to a real temple, and they're going to reinstitute their Old Testament worship, which did involve animal sacrifice and other things. And this is where we're going to get into some controversy, because as far as where it's located, we get some clues in this chapter 11 that may cause us to change our thinking about that. Everybody has, most people, let's say, have theorized that the new temple will be built on that Temple Mount in Jerusalem where the old temple stood. And so we're going to find out tonight whether that's true or not, okay? And the clues are going to come up in Revelation 11. And so I'm just going to give you kind of an overview on it. I've got a pretty detailed article on this subject on the website, and I'll refer you to that for further study. But let's just look at some of the clues we've looked at so far here. The first thing we know from the early part of the passage is John's told to go and measure a temple. So there's a temple there. He says in the end of verse 2 there, "Do not measure the outer court because it's been given to the Gentiles." and they'll trample on the holy city for 42 months. Now, one of the things that has interested temple scholars is that if you put the temple right where it was on the Temple Mount, the Dome of the Rock would be in the outer court. And so some people theorize that, well, that's what that means. The outer court, that's where the Dome of the Rock is. Now, this would somehow require that Israel and, let's just make it simple, the Jews and the Arabs would agree to let their two holy shrines stand side by side, 50 feet apart. The Islamic authorities have said, well, we'll have a world war before we allow that to happen. And some radicals in both the Jewish and in the Christian communities have said, well, we'll just blow up the Dome of the Rock. That'll take care of that. And so there's actually been attempts to do that. They've all been foiled, but groups have actually gotten together and tried to blow up the Dome of the Rock, thinking that that would be doing God a favor, as if he doesn't have enough trouble over there. They're going to help him out, right? So some people have theorized that. And so that's a logical position. There's also a view that the actual Temple Mount in the time of Jesus was 30 feet lower than it is today, that what we're seeing when we see the Temple Mount is really the foundations of a temple that Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, built there in 135 AD to the god Jupiter, which is the Greek Zeus, Roman Jupiter, same god, the chief of the gods. Because when Hadrian finally put down the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 AD, he made it illegal for Jews to enter Jerusalem. And he took load after load after load of gravel, and he laced it with salt, and he poured it over the destroyed temple area. And he built a new platform there, and he built a temple to Jupiter on that. He renamed the whole city. The city was called Aelia Capitolina for a number of years, because that's the name he gave to it. And so you've got that. You've got a theory then that the current Temple Mount is not really the place where the old temple stood. It's 30 feet above where the old temple stood. And the place where the old temple stood would be more like if you stood. Did you guys get to go up and touch the Western Wall? If you went right through the wall there, you know, you're way up. The wall is very tall there. And you notice how the stones are much bigger at the bottom than they are at the top? The big stones are signature of Herod. And so everybody believes that the big stones were built by Herod. But some people speculate the smaller stones on top were put there by Hadrian, the Roman Empire, later. But if the Jews were able to cut a hole in that wall at the ground level where they currently stand and walk into, it's hollow inside, if they were able to walk into there, according to some theorists, they would be standing in the old temple. And so there's that view, that the temple is actually under the current temple. But you know, the issue here is that everybody who's focused on this is focused on the fact that the next temple will be built where the last one was. It's pretty clear that the last temple was in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, stood somewhere near where the current Temple Mount is. And there are three major views. One view is it's just to the north of the Dome of the Rock. Did you get on the Temple Mount? Did they let you on there? See, that's why I stopped going, because they stopped letting people on. And so that was a major part of my tours. And so I stopped going over there when they closed the Temple Mount. But on the surface, on the platform, in the north end of it, there's a little thing called the Dome of the Spirits. And there's a view that that was the original Holy of Holies. And the bedrock comes right up through the pavement there. And it's the only place on the whole platform that is natural bedrock. The rest of it's all tile. And so some people believe the old temple was north of the Dome of the Rock. Others believe the old temple stood where the Dome of the Rock stands today. That's the second view. And the third view is that it was underneath, the one I just described to you. And those are the three major views about the temple. But I want to suggest to you something else. And I've shared this with the head of a group over there called the Temple Mount Faithful, Gershon Solomon. And he sort of patted me on the head and he says, that's a cute little Gentile boy. Why don't you go back home now? and we'll get on with things. So I didn't get anywhere with him. And he's a good friend, and I've had him in my house over here, and he's a fascinating guy. But he didn't buy any of this. And so, and this is not just my idea. This idea has been around for 100 years or so. But let me read a little bit to you, and then I'll show you a couple of other passages, and then I'm going to suggest to you an alternative that I think is a more likely one. Okay, so we're in the end of verse 2. It says, they'll trample on the holy city for 42 months. And I'll give power to my two witnesses, and they'll prophesy for 1,260 days. Now, I think the reason they have 42 months in one sentence and 1,260 days in the next, even though it's the same span of time, 42 months, 42 30-day months equals 1,260 days. And there's pretty good evidence that the Lord's calendar is a 30-day month calendar, a 360-day year. That's the way He created the world, and He's always maintained that calendar. We had to change the calendar when something happened to throw threw the Earth off its orbit in about 700 BC, and all the calendars of the world changed at the same time. But when the view is that when the world was created, God created it perfectly. He wouldn't create a thing with 365.256847 things. It has to be corrected every 4 years, except if it's a century, then you don't correct it, and then it still comes out every 25,000 years. It's wrong again. You have to fix it. That's not the way He does things. He made things perfect, and so the view is that He created the world with a 12 months, 30 day months, 360 day year, and that's the way He's maintained it all of a sudden. And so if you take 42 months, or 1,260 days, or 3.5 years, it all comes out the same. So My thought is that because they mention 42 months in one sentence and 1,260 days in another sentence, that the two are not the same. It's the same span of time, but they don't run contiguously. I believe that the two witnesses witness at a time that straddles the 70th week. In other words, they show up before the Great Tribulation starts, and they die before it ends. And so their 1,260, their 3.5-year ministry is not, you can't superimpose it upon the Great Tribulation, because they're certainly not there at the end of the age when the Lord comes back. And so I think they start early and they finish early. So anyway, that's one little point. And it says in verse 4, these are the two olive trees and the two lampstands stand before the Lord of the earth. The only other places that Lord of the earth phrase shows up are twice in Joshua and once in the book of Zechariah. And in the book of Zechariah is the only other place where there are two witnesses and two lampstands. And so in Zechariah 4, it talks about them being the messengers, if you will, of the Lord of the whole earth. And there are two fulfillments of that prophecy. One fulfillment was the local one during the time of Zechariah, and that was Zerubbabel and Joshua. Zerubbabel was the governor who was in charge of building the second temple. And Joshua was the high priest who officiated there. They were the original two sons of oil. But I think the prophecy in Zechariah 4, and if you want to go back and look at it, you can do that. It's an interesting prophecy. But I think the ultimate fulfillment of that prophecy in Zechariah 4 is these two witnesses here. Now in verse 5 it says, if anyone tries to harm them, fire comes out of their mouths and devours their enemies. This is how anyone who wants to harm them must die. And these men have the power to shut up the sky so it will not rain during the time they're prophesying. They have the power to turn the waters into blood and strike the earth with every kind of plague as often as they want. These two sentences identify the two witnesses as at least ministering in the power of or in the spirit of Moses and Elijah. Because of all the Old Testament figures, Moses is the one who brought plagues on the earth, and Elijah is the one that brought down fire from heaven and shut up the sky so it didn't rain. And if you go to James 5:17, you find out that the time when, remember when Elijah went up on Mount Carmel and they had the big contest between the two gods? And at the end of that contest, by the way, the Lord brought rain because there had been a drought in Israel. And you learn from James 5:17 that drought was exactly 3.5 years long, the same period of time as this drought is here. And so that gives a pretty good indication that one of those witnesses is at least in the spirit of Elijah. The second one, Moses, is clear in most people's minds because Moses is the one associated with the plagues. And as we talked about in our last session, the judgments, that come along in the first set of trumpet judgments, very similar to the plagues that came on Egypt. So I'm pretty much, as much as anybody could be, I'm pretty much persuaded that the two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. Some think it's Enoch and Elijah because those are two men who didn't die. Those are two Old Testament figures who went live into heaven, and so they could come back. Some actually see some New Testament figures there. John and Paul are mentioned, and what I think is they come in the spirit of Moses and Elijah, and they preach the message that John and Paul would preach, because it's a New Testament message. But that's just my opinion. Most scholars would place them as being Moses and Elijah. Now in verse 7 it says, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from the abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. And their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which is figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. Now that gives you a pretty good clue there. Their bodies will lie in the street of the great city. He says it's figuratively called Sodom and Egypt, but then he says it's where the Lord was crucified. So that pins it right down, doesn't it? So that means that their bodies lie in the streets of Jerusalem. All right, now here's where you have a problem. In verse 2, it says that the Gentiles will trample on the holy city for 42 months. In verse 8, it says that the bodies of the two witnesses lie in the street of the great city. So there's some place called the holy city in verse 2, and there's another place called the great city in verse 8. Are they the same? Well, look at this. The holy city trampled on for 42 months. Turn with me to Luke 21, and we're going to look in Luke 21, verse 24, I think it is. Luke 21, 24. In verse 24, Jesus talking about the destruction of Jerusalem. Let's back up to verse 20 and we'll start reading there. He says, and this Luke's passage is dealing with the time of the destruction of Jerusalem, 70 AD, during the life of the disciples. So he says in verse 20, when you see Jerusalem being surrounded by armies, you'll know that its desolation is near. Then let all those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, let those in the city get out, and let those in the country not enter the city. For this is the time of punishment and fulfillment, all that's been written. How dreadful it would be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. There'll be great distress in the land and wrath against this people. He's talking about the Jews here. Now look at verse 4. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And so here he's saying that Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. It's going to be destroyed in the lifetime of the disciples that he's talking to, Peter, James, John, and Andrew. The country's going to be scattered, and then Jerusalem is going to be given over to the Gentiles, and it will remain that way until the time of the Gentiles has been fulfilled. Well, everything happened just the way he said. In 70 AD, the Roman armies came in, they surrounded the place, and laid siege to the city. They slaughtered 1.2 million people in the city. They burned it to the ground. They didn't leave one stone standing on another of the temple, just like Jesus prophesied would happen. And that city from that day forward was a Gentile city. And it was a Gentile city until June 7th, 1967. That's over almost 2,000 years. And so, and the thing that gets me is they use the same word. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles for not 42 months, almost 2,000 years. And then you get in Revelation 11, and it says this holy city will be trampled on by the Gentiles for 42 months, 3.5 years. Doesn't gel. And then you put that together with the fact that you got the holy city in verse 2 and the great city in verse 8. And I started thinking, what if he's not talking about the same place? What if it's two different locations here? And so then I went back and started thinking like a rabbi. And I said, okay, there is a temple prophesied to be built that everyone agrees hasn't been built yet. It's given in such detail in the last 8 chapters of Ezekiel that you can actually build a model of it just from the scripture. You don't have to get any other information. You could actually, in fact, I've seen the Temple Institute has a model of it. And they built it right from scripture. And guess what? It won't fit on the Temple Mount. The temple precincts are miles square. The Temple Mount is not that big. This temple would not sit where they think the old temple sat. Well, then when you go into Ezekiel 48, what you discover is in the redistribution of the land, after the second coming. The temple is not located in Jerusalem. The temple is north in a place called Shiloh. It's about 12 kilometers or something north of there. It's where the tabernacle stood for the first 400 years after Joshua came into the promised land. And so I began looking at the possibility that the temple was somewhere else, or will be somewhere else. And that's when I ran across some of these old books that where other people have come up with this idea. And so I found out that the idea's been around for almost a couple hundred years. It's just most people don't talk about it anymore. But let me show you one or two more things, because then I want to derail the whole study on this, because we got lots of other things to do. But I want you to get enough of it to be curious enough to want to dig into it on your own. And turn with me to Zechariah 14, and let's look at that for a minute. Zechariah 14 is the, this describes events that take place on the day of the Lord's return. So we're in 14, and verse 1 says, "The day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you." Now that's mistranslated. It means right in front of your eyes. It means you're going to stand there and watch people split up your stuff. And it says, "I'll gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it," which, by the way, is one reason that Ezekiel 38 can't be here, because there are specific nations mentioned who are not involved in the battle of Ezekiel 38. But Zechariah 14 says that the second coming, all the nations will be fighting against Jerusalem. And it says the city will be ransacked, the houses, women raped, half the city go into exile, the rest of the city will not be taken. So half the city gets lost again. Verse 3, "The Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights on the day of battle. And on that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem. And the Mount of Olives will be split in two from east to west, forming a great valley, with half the valley moving north and half moving south." All right. You go into Acts chapter 1, and all the disciples with Jesus are standing on the Mount of Olives. And Jesus talks to them about things, and then he's taken up in the cloud. And as the disciples are standing there, Acts chapter 1 says, two men in white appear. And they say to them, "Men of Judea, why are you standing here looking into the sky? This same Jesus who you see going up will come back in the same manner." Now, in the early church, the tradition was these two men in white were Moses and Elijah. But that doesn't have anything to do with our story, but that's part of the early church tradition. But let's say that passage is literally true. We know where Jesus took off from. He took off from the top of the Mount of Olives, and there's a big tall tower up there called the Tower of the Ascension. You can see it from all over Jerusalem. Well, if you stand on the Mount of Olives, where he supposedly left from, and if he comes back just the way he left to the same place, and it says here when his foot touches down, that it'll cause an earthquake. Well, a few years ago, about 20 or 25, I guess, more than a few, there was a worldwide hotel chain that was owned by Pan Am, back when Pan Am was still around. Does anybody remember Pan American Airways? Okay. And you remember the Intercontinental Hotels? They were beautiful hotels. There was one in every major city around the world. And they were going to build one in Jerusalem. And they were going to build it on the Mount of Olives. And so they got through all the controversy and everything, and they had it all set up to do. And then they did their geological surveys, and they found out that there's this fault line that runs right through the center of the Mount of Olives from east to west. It goes from the Mount of Olives all the way out to the Mediterranean, and all the way on the other side down to the Dead Sea. And the geologist said, "This land is not stable. You can't build your hotel here." So they built it a little bit south. And today it's called the Seven Arches Hotel. You probably had lunch there. When we went, it's a Palestinian hotel today, so maybe they didn't let you go over there. But the Seven Arches Hotel was the Intercontinental Hotel. It was supposed to be built on the Mount of Olives, but this fault line stopped it. Okay, so if Jesus comes back to the same place he left from, the first place he's going to touch is that fault line, and of course that would trigger this earthquake. Now, if that were to happen, if that happens the way it appears to here, that fault line runs right straight through the Temple Mount. And if Jesus caused an earthquake there, that would split the Temple Mount in half, and everything that's on the Temple Mount would wind up in the bottom of this huge ravine, which immediately fills up with water. And then we'll go and see. Well, let's read on in Ezekiel 14 first. And it says in verse 8, "On that day," That's the very day he comes back. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea and half to the western sea in summer and winter. The eastern sea is the Dead Sea, and the western sea is the Mediterranean. And we're going to look at Ezekiel pretty soon, and that'll tell us that this water flowing out down through this ravine actually turns the Dead Sea fresh again. And the fish live there and everything, except for the very southern place where that's buried Sodom and Gomorrah. That stays salt in that area. But the rest of the Dead Sea becomes fresh again. And it says in Ezekiel, fruit trees line the banks, and fishermen line the banks all the way from east to west, and fish, and they catch fish out of there again. And the Dead Sea becomes alive again. And this Zechariah 14 says it happens on the day that the Lord arrives. All right, now let's go to Ezekiel 47. And you were doing this all in the Old Testament, remember, because the temple's an Old Testament deal. We're also going to get another look at this when we get to Revelation 22. And I may just take you there to give you a view of it as well. But for now, let's read this thing in Ezekiel 47. Okay, 47, Ezekiel 47. Ezekiel is, for the last seven chapters, he's been taking a tour in his vision about the new temple. In fact, the temple is called the third temple in some places. In other places, it's called Ezekiel's temple, because this is the only place where it's mentioned. Now, understand, the Jews call it the third temple. There have been two. So they think the Ezekiel's temple is going to be the next one. Christians talk about four temples because of Revelation 11 and because of their mindset that it has to go on the Temple Mount. They think, well, there's a temple that's built in Revelation 11 that gets desecrated, and then Ezekiel's temple is actually the fourth temple built during the millennium. I'm not so sure. But let's look at it. Ezekiel 47. The man brought me back. He's been taking this tour. He's been through the temple. He's been seeing all the things. It shows how they're going to operate the temple during the millennium, and it shows what the thing looks like, and he has all its dimensions of the city and everything, all that. He says, the man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple faced east. And the water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. Then he brought me out through the north gate and led me around out to the side and facing east, and the water was flowing from the south side. And this is three times he said the water flows south out of the temple. As a man went eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits and led me through waters an ankle deep. And this shows that this water, this river that's being created here, keeps getting bigger and bigger until finally it's a river he can't cross. Now you get down to verse 7. End of verse 6 says, he led me back to the bank of the river. When I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. And he said to me, this water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah. That's the fault that runs down through the Dead Sea. It's the lowest place on earth. It runs all the way into Africa. This Arabah is a geological fault line there, where it enters the sea. And when it enters into the sea, the water comes fresh. So that's the Dead Sea he's talking about, because it's flowing east. Swarms of living creatures live wherever the river flows. There'll be a large number of fish because the water flows there and makes the salt water fresh. So where the river flows, everything will live. Fishermen will stand along the shore from En-Gedi to En-Eglim. En-Gedi's on the eastern side, and En-Eglim is on the western side. And so it just says all around the lake, basically. Fishermen are going to stand there. And the fish will be of many kinds, like the fish in the Great Sea, which is the Mediterranean. And so from that, we get the idea that the fish can actually swim from the Mediterranean through this new river into the Dead Sea. And some of the fish that live in the Mediterranean will also be able to live in the Mediterranean, or in the Dead Sea, which will have to change the name of it because it'll no longer be dead. And it says, fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not fail, wither nor will their fruit. Every month they'll be bare fruit because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. And their fruit will serve for food and their leaves for healing. Now, that's almost identical to a passage in Revelation 22 where it talks about the river of life. And he says, on each side of the river stood the tree of life bearing 12 crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month, and the leaves were the tree for healing of the nations. That's Revelation 22:2. All right, so on the day the Lord arrives, his feet touch the Mount of Olives and cause the Mount of Olives to split in two, half going to the north, half going to the south. That split runs all the way from the Dead Sea to the Mediterranean. It completely wipes out the Temple Mount and puts it at the bottom of this huge ravine, which fills up with water flowing south from the temple. And it flows south until it hits this ravine, and then it splits. Half of it goes east and half of it goes west. And this giant river just flows down from the temple, which means the temple has to be north of wherever the split was. And guess where Shiloh is? It's just north by about 12 kilometers of where the current Temple Mount is. And so if the water flowed out on the day the Lord arrives, it says, if the water flowed out from under the south side of the temple, as soon as that earthquake hits and the water starts flowing, the river's created and everything works as long as you place the temple north of the current Temple Mount. Now, my view is here that when this Ezekiel 38 battle comes along and the Muslim troops are supernaturally defeated, the Jews see that God has won the battle for them. He starts drawing them back. He actually says that in the end of 39 of Ezekiel that he's going to draw every Jew on earth back to Israel, not leaving any behind. Now, I don't know if that means every biological Jew, because there's two kinds of Jews. There's a biological Jew and there's also a religious Jew, right? I don't know if he means all the biological, because there's as many of those outside of Israel that aren't inside. You know, about half the Jews in the world live in Israel. The other half live in other countries. Most of the other half lives in New York City. but I think when you got Israel and you got the U.S., that's 90% of all the Jews on earth. The other 10% are around the world somewhere. If he means he's going to bring them all back, that means Israel's suddenly going to get twice the size. If he only means the religious ones, that could be a smaller group. But in any event, he says, I'm going to bring all the Jews back, not leaving any behind. So they're all going to come back to Israel. They're all going to be in a relationship with God. They're going to demand a temple. And so how could that possibly happen? Well, suddenly arises this man of peace with this incredible plan for peace in the Middle East. And he says, well, read your own Bible, Israel. It says that your temple is actually located up here. You don't have to destroy the Dome of the Rock. That's all been polluted, according to your views. You don't have to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Your new temple is going to be over here. Build it. I'll help you. And we'll leave the Muslim temple alone. And that would satisfy everybody's requirements. The Jews would see that their own scriptures call for the temple to be built north. Because if you go into, by the way, if you follow this, read Ezekiel 48, get out a map, you can plot the land and you can see where the new temple is going to be. Because it's clear. And you can see where the land of Israel is going to be. It runs from 100 miles north of Damascus to 100 miles south of Jerusalem, west of the Jordan River. And you can see the division of the land. You can see where every tribe's land is going to be. And you can see that the holy city, as it's called here in Revelation 11, 2, is not in Jerusalem, but up north of there, in Shiloh. In Genesis 49, there's a prophecy that Jacob makes about Judah. I just happened to think of this. You triggered this, Betty, so we're going to follow this through. Because in Genesis 49, it says, 49:10, this is a prophecy Jacob made about Judah. It says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nations is his. Now, the King James translated that, the scepter shall not depart from between Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And that's where we get the name, Shiloh as being a name for the Messiah. Guess what the Jewish Bible says, the current translation, the English translation of the Jewish Bible says in this passage, it says, the scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he comes to Shiloh, indicating that Shiloh is a place as well as a name. Okay, so that's another little clue you get. Now, I don't know how inspired the current translations of the Jewish Bible are. They are very careful in their translations, and they have a very good, almost immaculate track record of staying true to the original text. But I just happened across that because I've got a Jewish version of the Old Testament translated into English, and that's what it says. That's what their authorized version, if you will, authorized translation says, that the scepter will not depart from between his feet until he comes to Shiloh. Well, that would be where the temple is. All right, now there's one more thing. In 165 BC, the Syrian king Antiochus Epiphanes came and basically overran Jerusalem. And he turned the temple into a pagan worship center and erected a statue of Zeus, the Greek god. Romans called him Jupiter, but same god. And he erected a statue of Zeus and put his own face on it. And he put it in the holy place, and he required everybody worship it on pain of death. He slaughtered a pig on the altar outside in the temple courts and made the Jewish priests begin using pigs as their sacrificial animals. This created the Maccabean uprising, and for 3.5 years there was this huge fight between the Syrians and the Jews, led by Judas Maccabeus, which means Judah the Hammer. And eventually, the Maccabees were successful. They drove the Syrians out. And when they did, they came to the temple, which had been desecrated in this way. They pulled the statue down, ground it up into powder, and threw it down in the Kidron River. They took the altar on which they had sacrificed these pigs and tore it down and got it away and built a new altar. And then they rededicated the temple. And they went through the regular rededication service. When they got to the part where you have to let the menorah burn for 8 days in the temple in order to purify it, they found out they only had 1 day's worth of oil. They didn't have 8 days worth, but they said, well, we'll burn what we have and hope that God calls it good enough. God made the oil burn for 8 days. And this is commemorated today in the Feast of Hanukkah, which happens around Christmas time. It turns out that if you plot... And I'm getting way too far into this now, so we're going to have to draw this to a halt. But it turns out if you plot the times that are listed in Daniel's 12th chapter about when the archangel Michael stands up to fight against Satan and 1,260 days becomes 1,290 days becomes 1,335 days, it turns out if you plot that all out, if the Lord comes back on Rosh Hashanah, which is the day I believe he'll come back, the second coming, on the 1260th day. And if he takes 10 days to get to the Yom Kippur, which the calendar calls for, it's on the 10th day. Rosh Hashanah is on the first day of the month. Yom Kippur is on the 10th day. And then if he takes the next 20 days doing the sheep and goat judgment, the judgment of the nations, he's gone 30 days now. So now we're down to 1,260 days. And then if it takes him 45 more days to get his kingdom set up and get everything organized and everything and get the temple ready for service and all that, he'll come out to the 1,335 days. And that 1,335th day happens to be the day we celebrate Hanukkah. And so I believe that this temple will be desecrated. Ezekiel's temple will be built in Shiloh, where Ezekiel says. It'll be desecrated by the Antichrist. And when the Lord comes back, he'll cleanse it and purify it, just like they did in the days of Judas Maccabeus in 165 BC, the celebrated in the Feast of Hanukkah. And that'll give us a prophetic fulfillment for the Feast of Hanukkah. And here's my evidence on that. You go to Ezekiel 43, and the Lord's coming back now. The temple is ready, and he's decided to come back and live there. And in Ezekiel 43, he says in verse 7, Son of man, this is the place of my throne. This is the place of my soles of the feet. This is where I will live among the Israelites forever. And the house of Israel will never again defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their prostitution, their lifeless idols, or the kings in the high places. And so this is the day the Lord returns, the Lord God, Jehovah, returns to the temple on earth. Then you go over to Ezekiel 44:7. And he has a complaint about them. And it says in 44:7, he says, in addition to all your other detestable practices, you brought foreigners uncircumcised in heart and flesh into my sanctuary, desecrating my temple while you offered me food, fat, and blood. You broke my covenant. Instead of carrying out your duty in regard to my things, my holy things, you put others in charge of my sanctuary. Well, guess who the other he's talking about? It's the Antichrist, who they permit to go into the temple and officiate and declare himself to be God and control the temple sacrifices. Now, he says, uncircumcised in flesh and in heart. we know that the Jews are circumcised in flesh. Who's circumcised in heart? Christians. And so the Antichrist is neither a Jew nor a Christian. And Daniel says he worships some foreign god that his father's never heard of. And so it's a lot of circumstantial evidence. But you start putting it together and it starts to add up. And I can make a pretty good case. I can make as good a case as anybody else can make. I can make as good a case for my view as anybody else can make for their view. That this temple, when it's built, will be built in Shiloh. It'll be the tribulation temple. It'll be desecrated by the Antichrist. And it'll be cleansed at the beginning of the millennium by the Lord. And on the day that we celebrate Hanukkah, the temple will be ready. The millennial temple will be ready for service. And I think I can take that, and I can at least convince myself of that. So this is why I believe that we've got to take a second look here because of these clues. We got to take a second look here to solve the conundrum that takes place between the Muslims and the Jews as to how they're going to coexist in Jerusalem. And my answer to that, they're not. Okay, that runs us out of time for tonight. And so what I'm going to do is close the study here, and we'll pick it up when I get next time. We'll pick it up where we left off there in Revelation 11, because there's lots of things in 11 and 12 that we still have to go through with. And in the meantime, if any of this has sparked any curiosity on your part, I would recommend that you, there's an article on the website called The Coming Temple, and where we go into this in detail. I compare the current Temple Mount with the Temple Mount that's listed in Ezekiel, and I show you how they can't be the same. I also compare the new temple, the millennial temple, with the new Jerusalem, showing you how the new Jerusalem can't be the new temple, and that the fact is that this third temple, Ezekiel's temple, I believe, is the temple that's going to be built at the beginning of Daniel's 70th week. It'll be used through the first half of that 70th week. The Antichrist will defile it in the middle, rendering unfit for use. The Lord will come back. He'll cleanse it, and this will be the temple they use in the millennium. All right, let's have a closing prayer, and then I'm going to shut off the recording, and then we can take any of your questions you might have.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.